something to keep the value of the ruble from falling. The downside to that is that these big companies are sooner or later going to have to buy more dollars to pay off their foreign debts. So all these tactics are just kicking the can down the road. Standard & Poor's, the big rating company, says it's going to decide next month whether it should reduce Russia's debt rating to junk bond status, and that could set off another round in the crisis.
All right, a tough time for Russia because of these falling oil prices. Corey, thanks a lot.
Thank you, David.
That's NPR's Corey Flintoff in Moscow. Now, it's a totally different story in this country. Low oil prices are a big reason for the positive economic news this week. The Commerce Department says the U.S. economy is growing at its fastest pace in 11 years. Consumer spending is up, and of course, gas prices are way down. As NPR's Chris Arnold reports, in 2015, cheaper gas could be the thing that finally kicks the economic recovery into a higher gear.
For most Americans, wages have been stagnant since before the financial crisis. But for many, especially if they drive a lot, right now they're getting, in effect, a pay raise in the form of cheaper gas. In fact, if prices stay where they are right now, around $2.40 a gallon, that would mean an extra $1,500 per household next year. Based on median household income, that's a 3% raise for the entire country.
Oh, yeah. It's a game changer, and it's going to really help us going into 2015.
That's Bob Costello. He's the chief economist of the American Trucking Associations, so he pays close attention to fuel prices and what they mean for the economy.
This is the shot in the arm that could get us finally going on a more consistent basis.
Costello is talking about the overall economy, but he says if you zoom in on the trucking industry, you see some especially good things happening.
This is an industry that consumes almost 38 billion gallons of diesel every year.
And with diesel prices down nearly a dollar a gallon, you don't have to be an economist to figure out that trucking companies are already saving together billions of dollars on fuel. And that can create what's called a virtuous cycle, where that savings or extra money gets put back into the economy, boosting it in other ways.
I talk to trucking companies every week that say, you know, we went out and bought 10 new trucks in the last month.
That's the sound of a truck at Dark Horse Express, which is a small trucking company outside of Nashville, Tennessee. Jeff Hickman's the owner. He's got 15 trucks on the road, which means compared to last year, he is saving a lot of money on fuel.
It's anywhere from $5,000 to $6,000 a week. For a company our size, it's huge.
Hickman says many trucking companies are hauling more stuff this year, too. He specializes in frozen food, so he's got some truckloads of turkeys headed to grocery stores, some frozen pizzas.
Everybody is busy. I don't know anybody that has trucks sitting because there's not freight for them to move.
And Hickman says that means that he's been using some of that savings on fuel to pay higher wages to his truck drivers because there's more competition to get good drivers and to keep them.
We are paying our drivers almost 10% more over last year's wages.
Other workers in other industries should be so lucky. Overall, there's been very little growth in wages, though one recent report showed that maybe they're finally starting to rise. But either way, cheaper gas is putting money into people's pockets. Over in Idaho Falls, Idaho, 23-year-old Lacey Benyon says gas is just $2.29 a gallon.
It's been a huge blessing for me and for my family. My husband and I are newlyweds. We haven't been married for quite a year yet. He's still a student, and I'm working full-time.
Benyon says she's driving an old Dodge Stratus with 200,000 miles on it, which, of course, doesn't get the best gas mileage. So with the extra money, she says she and her husband actually felt better about buying a few more presents this year, including some stuff for their kitchen.
It feels good to buy something new that we've needed for a long time because you feel it that much better because you really needed that thing.
And heading into the new year, the economy is continuing to gain jobs and grow more quickly. Wages, as we said, may even be starting to rise a bit. So add in the cheaper gas and things are looking better than they have in a long time. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
And things have been looking really good for the airline industry. The lower price of fuel is a big reason for that. Another reason, with the economy recovering, more people are getting on planes and flying, both for business and pleasure. So, good year for the airlines, but as anyone traveling for the holidays this week will tell you, they are not passing their savings on to passengers. Here's NPR's David Shaper.
With many of us now taking off on a holiday break and the end of the year upon us, it's a good time to give out end-of-the-year grades. I recently asked frequent flyers going through Chicago's O'Hare Airport what grade they'd give their airlines.
Well, I'd probably give them a B.
T Tanya Lawson is an attorney on her way home to Miami. Says she doesn't have too many complaints. Lawson gives the airlines high marks for being on time for the most part, but she's not happy with everything.
I think comfort has gone out the window completely. Another airline I traveled on recently, my knees were too long, and I was in pain, literally, for the entire flight, and I'm only 5'8".
I'd give them a C.
Sydney Moraney is a psychiatrist from Jackson, Tennessee.
I give them a C. When it's bad, it's pretty bad, but a lot of times it's efficient. The planes are always pretty full now, that's one thing. You're packed in there pretty tight.
And both Moraney and Lawson and others say they're tired of airlines charging for everything from extra baggage to extra legroom. As for the base fares, though, many travelers say they aren't too terribly high if you buy far enough in advance. But Moraney notices that while the price of fuel plummets, air fares are still up.
They're not coming down, relatively speaking, the way gas has come down.
Do you think they should?
Sure they should. They're making profits.
That's true. The International Air Transport Association estimates the world's airlines will rake in nearly $20 billion in profits this year, and the group expects that figure to soar to a record $25 billion next year. And with fuel making up close to half of the airline's expenses, they are saving money. But the airlines say it's not as much as you'd think, and the fuel price plunge comes after near-record high prices. John Heimlich, chief economist for the industry group Airlines for America, says airlines are using their windfalls now to pay down debt, to give investors dividends for the first time in decades, and to improve the flying product.
So we continue to see new aircraft coming to the system, facilities improving, a more stable, better-trained workforce, in-flight, tablets, proliferation of Wi-Fi. Now you're seeing it more in international markets.
But at least some of those amenities won't be free to all passengers. Airlines have begun offering far fewer cheap seats, and they're separating passengers into more classes, with each level you go up in price coming with a few more perks and comforts.
Bells and whistles are being added if you are paying premium prices.
George Hamlin is president of Hamlin Transportation Consulting.
I think it would be fair to say that the game here is pay to play. If you want the cheapest fare, don't look for the primo product.
Looking ahead to 2015, Hamlin says travelers should continue to expect jam-packed planes and high fares. As demand for air travel continues to rise, recent mergers reduce competition, and airlines have reduced excess seat capacity to better match demand. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's 8:18. Thanks for listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. Good morning. It's been a deadly year for journalists on the job around the world. Dozens died in 2014, and nearly half of them were targeted for murder. We'll bring you that story at 8:33. Our weather today, heavy fog advisories in effect for parts of Wisconsin. We should see some occasional light rain and light snow today as well.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus, honoring personal legacies in the circle of life. They believe that every detail counts and every memory matters. Piasecki Althaus is located in Kenosha on 39th Avenue, serving the community since 1931.
To make a Kwanzaa placemat and mini gingerbread house, Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support seasonal activities for kids. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Rain and strong storms are moving across much of the eastern U.S. this morning on this busy Christmas Eve travel day. It's making the trek slower for a lot of people. Airports are bracing for flight delays, especially at Chicago's O'Hare and Midway airports. That's where snow is expected before the day's over. In Mississippi, they're surveying the damage from suspected tornadoes that left four people dead and damage described as
Extensive. Homes and businesses along U.S. Highway 98 and Mississippi Highway 13 in Marion County, real close to the city of Columbia. And in Jones County, it appears to be a lot of home damage, and there are some businesses.
That's Greg Flynn with Mississippi Emergency Management. In suburban St. Louis, Missouri this morning. crowds gathering at a gas station where police say last night an officer shot and killed an 18-year-old man who pointed a gun at him. It happened in Berkeley, not far from Ferguson, where the fatal police shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown back in August prompted nationwide protests. First-time jobless claims in the U.S. are down. The Labor Department says they fell 9,000 last week to their lowest level in 7 weeks, a seasonally adjusted 280,000. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell. The controversial movie The Interview will apparently be shown in a handful of Wisconsin theaters. Sony Pictures announced yesterday the action comedy about a plot to assassinate the leader of North Korea will open as planned on Christmas Day, that's tomorrow, but in a very limited release. Sony says the film has been booked in Ashland, Beloit, Eagle River, Fond du Lac, Hartford, Hayward, Janesville, New London, Platteville, Shawano, Sparta, and Sturgeon Bay. More than 100 people in Milwaukee have gone to the hospital with the flu. Milwaukee Health Commissioner Bevin Baker says flu-related illnesses have gone up significantly since Thanksgiving, and most of those going to the hospital are aged 50 or older. A recent statewide survey by Aurora Healthcare showed that only one in four Wisconsinites were worried about getting the flu this winter, and three of every 10 did not plan on getting flu shots. Milwaukee health officials urge people to wash their hands frequently to avoid spreading the flu virus and to use arms instead of hands to cover coughs and sneezes. One man was killed and two others were hurt last night when their all-terrain vehicles broke through the ice on Fox Lake in Dodge County. Two of the riders got out of the water by the time rescuers arrived, but a third was in the lake for about an hour. He was pronounced dead at the hospital. A Fox Lake police officer suffered a minor injury during the rescue effort. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell. More news at 8:42.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Novo Nordisk, committed to innovation in diabetes care for over 90 years. More at novonordisk-us.com. From the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, working to improve the quality of people's lives by supporting the performing arts, the environment, medical research, and child well-being. Information is available at ddcf.org. From Margo and John Ernst, supporting North Country Public Radio in Canton, New York, and NPR's environmental coverage, which helps to raise awareness on issues surrounding climate change. And from the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries. On the web at lemelson.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green. This holiday season, images of the Virgin Mary, created over five centuries, glow on the walls of the National Museum of Women in the Arts here in Washington, D.C. Mary's role as woman, mother, and idea is portrayed by the likes of Michelangelo, Botticelli, Rembrandt, and other artists from the 14th through 19th centuries. NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg says, through the ages, the Virgin has played many parts.
Holy Mary, Holy Mother of God, Holy Virgin of Virgins.
Catherine Watt, Chief Curator of the Women in the Arts Museum, recites a litany of Mary's titles.
Virgin most renowned, Virgin most powerful.
For centuries, Christians have cherished the many aspects of Mary and still have very personal views.
Being brave and strong. And I think sometimes people see meekness and humility. I see that too. But undergirding all of that, I see strength.
Mary is one of the main themes in Western art for more than 1,000 years.
Monsignor Timothy Verdon is guest curator of the exhibition. He's canon of the Florence Cathedral and director of the Museo dell'Opera del Duomo there.
Not only are there more images of her than of almost anyone else, including her son. Her son is often part of the image, but the interest of the image is normally more focused on Mary, who is the adult, than on the Christ child, who's a sweet child.
In the 1460s, Fra Filippo Lippi of Florence saw the Madonna as regal, queenly, a kind of Byzantine empress.
Mary is unexpectedly fashionable with a splendid crimson underdress and a rich mantle, and my goodness, pearls adorning her diaphanous veil, that kind of very delicate fabric, was immediately recognized at the period as a luxury fabric.
Her filigreed halo is made of gold. Her face is serene. But there's a sadness there, a premonition that the big-bellied baby she hugs will meet suffering and death.
This and other similar works in which we feel that aura of sadness were made in an age when one of the most common facts in society was infant mortality. And so for people to see the Madonna and the child veiled with this premonition of suffering really fit into a very important part of their lives.
Botticelli's Madonna from 1480 is also reflective, exquisite, in her deep blue robe and delicate golden halo. A century later, in 1570, Federico Barocci's Mary is very human. She's picnicking on the flight into Egypt. Her head is bare. She's put her straw hat on the ground. She's barefoot. And as her baby reaches happily for some cherries Joseph is offering, Mary catches stream water into a silver bowl.
This becomes a wonderful symbol of what womanhood and especially motherhood is. It's a source of life for the families. It's a wonderfully simple, charming, at the same time, deep picture.
Monsignor Verdon stops at another bareheaded Mary, chalked in red by Michelangelo around 1525. This Mary is powerful.
Not only is her head uncovered, her arms are uncovered, and it looks as if she spends all of her free time at the gym.
She's got muscles. Verdon says Michelangelo is showing the strength of human desire for God. Each work in the Picturing Mary exhibition is layered with meaning. A bowl of fruit symbolizes fecundity. A closed book moves God's word to her womb. A thorn bracelet foreshadows Christ's agony on the cross. A few women artists are present. In the 17th century, Artemisia Gentileschi broke from traditions that kept women painting still lives and portraits to show a theological topic in a way no man had done. Mary is nursing her child. Curator Catherine Watt.
The idea here is that it's quite forthright. She's revealed her breast, the baby's getting ready to nurse and so forth. It's very frank, and this is not the way that male artists typically treated the subject, where they were a little more roundabout, and things were sort of more unnatural looking or shaded somehow with fabric, or the position was a little bit different, and this is just all right there.
Artemisia's Mary is monumental. She fills the canvas, an earthy, natural woman holding the breast to her eager child. No trace of false modesty or shame. Society and the church wanted different Marys as the centuries passed. Artists reflected those shifts. By 1884, Barabino designs a mural with the basic Marian elements, blue robe, halo, book of God's word. But her face is veiled, and there's no baby. So she has become an abstract idea rather than a specific mother, queen, virgin. This is a work about faith.
So faith suddenly is impersonated by Mary. Mary becomes the most emblematic figure of what it means to be a believer.
Why this change, the different emphasis? Monsignor Verdon says it's the 1880s version of keeping up with the times.
The world had already become much less Christian than it had been in earlier periods. The church, knowing that, looks for a neutral and almost philosophical language in which to repropose some of the traditional beliefs. And so, since everyone would agree that faith, which may not necessarily be religious faith, it could be political faith, it could be a faith in ethical principles, that faith is a good thing.
Faith, belief, worship, holiness, and in the foreground, the Mother of God to Christians around the globe.
Ark of the Covenant, Gate of Heaven, Morning Star.
The exhibition Picturing Mary will be at the National Museum of Women in the Arts until April. Standing amid the 60 artworks, many of them masterpieces, the show's curator, Monsignor Timothy Verdon, has a simple answer when asked about the many facets of the Blessed Mother.
Speak personally. Who is your Mary?
She's my mother.
I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News, Washington.
And if you want to feel like you're right there with Susan in that museum, you can see some pictures from the exhibition at npr.org. This is NPR News.
Later today, will Republican control of Congress change President Obama's approach to governing?
He's got 2 years left. That could be the most productive 2 years he has in terms of achieving a lasting consensus on things that make a difference.
The president and the new Congress. That story later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 3 on Wisconsin Public Radio and WPR.org.
Good morning, I'm David Green. Yesterday was Festivus, that Seinfeld-inspired holiday with an annual airing of grievances. Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul took to Twitter to complain that his Democratic colleague Cory Booker didn't retweet him enough, that the government spent $300,000 studying synchronized swimming in sea monkeys, that no matter how many times he asked, Mitch McConnell would not let him borrow his sweater vest, and that there just are not enough puppies in politics. You're listening to Morning Edition.
It's 8:31. Thanks for listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad managed to get reelected for another term this year, despite nearly 3 years of civil war in his country. That might mean he's likely to stay in power.
Assad is in a stronger position today in many respects, certainly on the battlefield, and he has the United States as a strategic ally.
In our continuing series about world leaders in 2014, we'll explore how Assad has managed to gain ground in a nation that's been torn apart by conflict. That's coming up right after this break.
Support for WPR comes from Steep & Brew, a Wisconsin coffee roaster dedicated to delivering truly fresh, premium coffee to local grocers. Coffee roasted today is delivered within 72 hours. Steep & Brew, coffee done right. More at steepandbrew.com.
WGTD broadcasts from studios located on the Kenosha campus of Gateway Technical College. In Kenosha and Racine, WGTD is heard at 91.1 FM, Elkhorn at 101.7, Lake Geneva 103.3, and around the world at WGTD.org.
What can we look forward to next year? How about more internet everywhere and more ways for advertisers to find us?
We're going to be connected and more effectively connected, not just by our cell connection, but by Wi-Fi all the time.
I'm Adrian Hill. The internet, ads, and everyday life. Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Right after All Things Considered, tonight at 6:30 on Wisconsin Public Radio and WPR.org. Our weather today, cloudy with patchy fog. We're seeing some dense fog in much of Wisconsin this morning. After that, occasional light rain and light snow with afternoon highs in the low to mid-30s.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from CarMax, offering more than 35,000 used cars and trucks online and in stores from coast to coast. Learn more at CarMax.com. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at MacFound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green. 2014 has been another deadly year for people who cover the news. The Committee to Protect Journalists has issued a report saying at least 60 reporters, photographers, and other members of the media were killed this year while on the job. Nearly half of those were targeted for murder. Here's NPR's Jackie Northam.
The Committee to Protect Journalists compiles details of journalist deaths worldwide, whether it's a reporter or a photographer killed as a direct reprisal for their work, caught in combat-related crossfire, or carrying out a dangerous assignment. Joel Simon, the executive director of the CPJ, says this year's numbers are down slightly from 70 the previous year. But he says the last few years have been the deadliest since the organization began keeping records in 1992.
This has been the most dangerous 3 years that we've ever documented. And there are a number of cases outstanding that we continue to investigate.
Syria continues to be the most dangerous place for journalists for the third year in a row. At least 17 members of the media were killed there this year, including American freelance journalists James Foley and Stephen Sotloff, who were beheaded by militants from the self-proclaimed Islamic State. The report says overall, the Middle East is the deadliest region for journalists. For the first time in several years, members of the media were also killed in Ukraine, Turkey, Myanmar, and Paraguay. Three journalists were killed by villagers while covering the Ebola outbreak in Guinea. The report says violence against journalists in Egypt, Pakistan, and the Philippines is endemic. The CPJ's Simon says the overwhelming majority of journalists at risk are local people.
The reality is that it is local journalists working in their own countries who are most at risk, and it is also local journalists working in their own countries who are often responsible for bringing the news to a global audience.
And the report says an unusually high proportion of those killed, roughly 25%, were foreign correspondents, about double the amount the CPJ has recorded in the past. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Washington.
All right, as Jackie mentioned, Syria is the most dangerous place for journalists. It is a place that is so dangerous for so many people. There's a bloody civil war there. And many, including the United Nations, blame President Bashar al-Assad for killing tens of thousands of his own people. As we finish off 2014, we've been looking at how world leaders have fared. President Assad started the year at the negotiating table. NPR's Alice Fordham looks at how his fortunes changed.
It's January 2014. It's Switzerland. It's freezing. And negotiators are gathered at the United Nations. Bashar al-Assad is not there, but his ministers are, and they face the leaders of the opposition. John Kerry is there too and calls loudly for a political transition. He's pretty clear about who won't be involved.
Bashar al-Assad will not be part of that transition government. There is no way possible in the imagination that the man who has led the brutal response to his own people could regain the legitimacy to govern.
Let's fast forward to right now. Those talks were abandoned. Bashar al-Assad is still in the presidential palace in Damascus. And although the United States is bombing Syria, it's not targeting Assad's army, but the so-called Islamic State, or ISIS.
I think Assad is in a stronger position today in many respects, certainly on the battlefield, and he has the United States as a strategic ally.
This is longtime Syria analyst Joshua Landis, a professor at the University of Oklahoma. What's happened, he says, is that ISIS got so big and bad, the U.S. had to target them, even if that meant helping Assad out. To understand how we got to this point, we'll go back to spring, when Syria had a presidential election. The EU and US called it illegitimate, but Assad supporters hailed him as a legit winner. Lawmakers applauded him before an inauguration speech. He said the true motive of those who had called for freedom and democracy had been revealed as being murder. And congratulated Syrians on voting. Essentially, he said people had realized the Syrian uprising was led by terrorists. Western leaders scoffed, but then his argument got a huge boost right in the heat of summer. ISIS surged over the Syrian border and through the Iraqi city of Mosul, where they filmed themselves celebrating. Suddenly, they controlled a big oil-rich swath of territory stretching across Iraq and Syria. And an American-led air campaign began to push back the growing ISIS threat. President Obama insists this doesn't mean he's partnering with Assad, but with both sides bombing the same places, people on the ground often think that the two are on the same side. Many moderate anti-Assad activists believe Assad purposely allowed the extremists to become strong. His army targeted more moderate rebels, not ISIS. They say the strategy is that if Western leaders can only choose between Assad and ISIS, they'll choose Assad to bring back stability. But analyst Randa Sleem of the Middle East Institute isn't sure that's a good plan.
This whole approach is based on a faulty assumption, and the assumption being Assad can somehow stabilize the situation.
Sleem points out manpower is dwindling in Assad's army and paramilitaries. I talk to Munza Akbik, a leader of the political opposition who was in those talks at the beginning of the year. Now, that opposition is weaker.
Political opposition is weaker for a very simple reason, because we are unable to provide more support for our people.
Akbik has little faith that more negotiations proposed by Russia for 2015 will make any difference. The US and its allies say they plan to train a force of moderate rebels next year to pressure Assad. But most analysts think the president is likely to stay in power. It'll just be over a country ever more fractured and bloody. Alice Fordham, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It's 8:41. Thanks for listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. Good morning. Coming up in 10 minutes on the Marketplace Morning Report, the business of direct-to-home Christmas tree delivery. Our weather forecast today, some areas of dense fog in Wisconsin this morning, patchy the rest of the day with occasional light rain and light snow, and afternoon highs in the low to mid-30s.
Our listeners tell us that WPR helps them through some difficult times just by being there. We are here for you because you support our programming. If WPR is a constant companion in your life, you may want to consider becoming a member of the 9XM Leadership Circle with a gift of $100 a month or more. Call 800-383-9772 or visit WPR.org/support and click Leadership. Thank you.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Moviegoers are buying up tickets for Sony Entertainment's The Interview now that the comedy film's being released. It's being shown in more than 200 theaters across the U.S. beginning tomorrow, Christmas Day. Robert Sausado was with the Alamo Drafthouse in Houston.
We've gotten a lot of requests since the movie was pulled for us to be able to show it in some capacity. And so the interest is definitely there. A lot of our shows here in Houston are already sold out. For Christmas Day and for the day after. So people want to see this movie.
Sony originally planned to release the movie in 3,000 theaters. Despite pleas from New York City's mayor, leaders of police protests say they're not suspending their demonstrations.
There have been calls to put aside the protests. Well, I will tell you this. The NYPD and the police around this country have not put aside their murdering of our people.
That's Travis Morales with the group Stop Mass Incarceration. Mayor Bill de Blasio wants protesters to halt their demonstrations until after the funerals of two NYPD officers shot and killed last weekend. Police in suburban St. Louis, Missouri, say an officer shot and killed an 18-year-old last night at a gas station when the man pointed a gun at him. It happened in the town of Berkeley, not far from Ferguson. New claims for jobless benefits in the U.S. dropped 9,000 last week. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell. A state senator from the heart of Wisconsin's wolf hunting territory wants the new Congress to give Wisconsin back its authority to manage its own wolves. Hazelhurst Republican Tom Tiffany predicts last Friday's federal court ruling that returned the gray wolf to the endangered species list will be overturned by 2017. Yesterday, Tiffany asked the state's congressional delegation to examine the Endangered Species Act. As a result of last week's ruling, Wisconsin's three-year-old wolf hunt is canceled, and farmers can no longer shoot problem wolves, which damage their crops and livestock. Local unemployment rates decreased in most major Wisconsin cities last month, but went up in most counties. The Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development's preliminary rates for November showed unemployment went down or remained the same in 23 of Wisconsin's 32 largest cities. Racine had the highest rate at 8.4%. Caledonia had the lowest rate at 2.7%. Wisconsin's unemployment rate statewide for November was 5.2%. That's the lowest it's been since the Great Recession. An appeals court has upheld a conviction against a former aide of Governor Walker when Walker was Milwaukee County Executive. Tim Russell was Walker's deputy chief of staff and was charged with stealing more than $21,000 from a charity benefiting veterans. He pleaded guilty to a felony theft count and was sentenced to 2 years in prison in 2012. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, combining conventional and integrative therapies to help maintain quality of life during treatment at cancercenter.com. From the estate of Joan Kroc, whose bequest established the Kroc Fellowships to develop the next generation of extraordinary journalists for public radio. And from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their solutions to the world's most pressing problems. Learn about the Social Entrepreneurs Challenge at skoll.org.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. Well, many kids are crazy for horses. Writer Julie Buckles was no different when she was a girl. This morning, she tells us about her family's horsey history.
As a girl, I was crazy for horses. I painted and collected ceramic horses, read Misty of Chincoteague religiously, and galloped around our dairy farm as if riding the range. Bonanza was my favorite program, and for a period, I imagined that I was Little Joe, rounding up cattle and fighting off bad guys. Every year, I would take a red pen, encircle the gun and holster set in the Sears catalog, and send that page off to Santa. But Santa, apparently, was a pacifist. You'd think, having all that desire, that space, and access to hay, we might have had horses, but my parents were not horse people. We were practical dairy people, and horses were an afterthought at best. When I was 5, my Grandpa Joe got a pony named Rusty for my twin uncles, a dubious deal, negotiated over drinks at the DeSoto Tavern. The selling point for Grandpa was that Rusty could singlefoot. No one knew what that meant, least of all Grandpa, but he liked to talk about Rusty's singlefoot and ability. When my cousin Diane begged her dad for a horse, Grandpa offered Rusty and even delivered him to their farm. Rusty immediately partnered with a black Angus heifer and disappeared into what my Uncle Levon called ditchweed, or wild marijuana. Rusty's greatest trick was to find a low-hanging branch, run at it at top speed, and knock Diane off as fast as you could say, singlefoot. Diane is still fuming. When I was 10, my dad drove in the driveway with a borrowed trailer containing a pony named Toby. The details are fuzzy, but Toby came from the county farm, free and with a saddle. Circus peanuts and grooming pleased Toby, but having riders on his back did not. His favorite trick was to take Dad and me to the farthest point of the farm, buck us off, and then for good measure, rear up and try and trample us. I still loved him. At 15, I lobbied for an Appaloosa named Shasta that came cheap at the end of the season from a riding farm. She had one fantastic quality. She was pregnant. My family's one, and possibly only, horsey highlight arrived one Easter morning with the birth of Cesare, a spindly foal. We'd seen plenty of calves born, but nothing as gorgeous as this. The entire extended family leaned on the wooden fence and watched him weave and wander and eventually suckle. From that beautiful beginning, there was no direction but down. Shasta bucked Mom onto her head, and she refused to ride. Then Shasta rolled with my younger brother attached, and he refused to ride, and Cesare grew into a willful teenager. After high school, I hopped in a truck with my boyfriend for a summer of camping out west before starting UW-Madison. The horses broke through the fencing, and with no one around to ride them, or even really who liked them, Dad unilaterally decided to sell. When I got back, I cried and I yelled, but I knew it was over. I went to say goodbye to my horses back at the riding ranch. Tearfully, I stood at the side of the fence, waiting for my bonanza moment, when Shasta and Cesare would sense my presence, gallop over, and nuzzle me. But it never came, and I drove to college.
Julie Buckles is a writer who lives in Ashland. She's the author of Paddling to Winter. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television. And you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. Good morning. A classical music special comes your way at 9 o'clock, the Festival of Nine Lessons and Carols, live from England. That's at 9 o'clock, right after the Marketplace Morning Report.
WGTD is owned and operated by Gateway Technical College and is an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio and NPR. To learn more and to take full advantage of our services, visit WGTD.org. To have a program schedule mailed to you, call 262-564-3030.
Drive in Madison. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support free, family-friendly activities. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
Our weather forecast for Wisconsin today, dense fog advisories in effect for much of the state today. Fog should be a fact of life throughout the day today, as well as occasional light rain and light snow. We expect afternoon highs to reach the low to mid-30s and overnight lows in the mid to upper 20s. Christmas Day should be cloudy and mild, with a chance of light snow in the northwest and afternoon highs in the mid to upper 30s.
Support for WPR comes from Dottie Dumplings Dowry, a family-owned business in downtown Madison, celebrating 40 years, offering a variety of gourmet hamburgers, fresh salads, homemade soup, and more. Open daily for lunch and dinner on Francis Street.
Support for WGTD comes from Vero International Cuisine in Racine on 6th Avenue near Monument Square, featuring American food with an international twist in a serene setting with intimate and exotic touches. Online at verointernationalcuisine.com.
Could stock investors enjoy not a repeat but a hat trick in 2015?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, I'm David Brancaccio in Washington, D.C. today. In the last week, the Dow has risen precisely 1,000 points. This after Federal Reserve policymakers were studiously noncommittal about raising interest rates. Although the spike in gross domestic product reported yesterday for the third quarter could bring rates higher soon, share prices are still rising. 21 minutes into the Christmas Eve trading, let's do the numbers. Find the Dow up 44 points, 0.25% to 18,068. Yes, 1,000 points higher than the close on Tuesday of last week. The S&P 500 up 0.2%. The NASDAQ up 0.25%. Now, after stocks rose so much in 2013, some investors were leery about this year. Yet I just calculated the S&P 500 is up just under 15% New Year's to now. I asked David Leibovitz, global market strategist at J.P. Morgan Funds, to lay it on the line about 2015. He's still thinking prices will generally be up.
We'll see, you know, high single digits, low double digits in 2015. All that being said, the key part of this equation is earnings, because any deterioration there would signify that perhaps this market doesn't have as much room to run as some of us previously thought.
So not quite what we've been seeing the last couple of years, but you're thinking it still could be a decently strong stock market as we move forward.
As long as companies continue to make money, investors should be willing to pay more. I think it'll be important to watch the fourth quarter earnings season, see the effects of a stronger dollar and lower oil prices on corporate profits. As long as companies are generating a solid cash flow, that makes them a better investment and much better than high-quality fixed income.
Even with these low oil prices, I mean, that can hurt energy company stocks, and that can be a drag on the market in the new year.
What lower oil prices do is they put more money in the pocket of the consumer. And in a consumption-driven economy like the U.S., where consumption accounts for about 70%, that's a much stronger force than what may be going on in the energy sector specifically.
David Leibovitz, global market strategist at J.P. Morgan Funds, thank you so much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
We also have word today that prosecutors in South Korea have indicted the CEO of Uber, the San Francisco-based company where customers summon rides using their smartphones, facing bans from India to Spain. The new problems in Seoul, where we find the BBC's Steve Evans. Hello, Steve.
Good day to you.
What is this? The CEO of the car service Uber is under indictment in South Korea?
He is. Travis Kalanick is charged with violating transportation law in South Korea. And the argument is that he's the CEO of the company, which breaks the law. So the South Korean authorities say Uber has been facing bans in Thailand, in India, in Spain, and in Holland. When you get a new technology threatening an old technology, you have the laws in place for the old technology, and the new technology comes and bumps up against those laws. And what sometimes happens, if a new technology is very effective, is that the law gets changed slowly.
But indictment of the CEO? I mean, if Kalanick got on a flight from San Francisco to Seoul, would he get busted if he got off the plane?
I mean, the indictment isn't there now. This is what the prosecution is suggesting. But absolutely, if he travels into this jurisdiction as somebody indicted by a court, he could be arrested and put before that court. He's facing lots of arguments in lots of jurisdictions. And each time he says, we do it legally, and furthermore, the people love us. So it's the same kind of dispute, if you like, as is happening in lots and lots of places.
The BBC's Steve Evans in South Korea. Steve, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Invest Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland, a European location offering an educated, loyal, agile workforce at the ready. More at investni.com. And by Citrix GoTo Meeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device. More at gotomeeting.com.
From the point of view of Santa's elves, what we have next is a case of mission creep. First, arranging all the gifts, but now somebody's supposed to deliver the tree to people's houses. Marketplace's Annie Baxter now on the business of direct-to-the-home Christmas tree delivery.
In the days leading up to Christmas, one of Santa's elves has been making stops at homes like this one in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Hi, Brandon. Merry Christmas.
Are you Brandon?
I'm Brandon the Elf.
Okay,
yes.
Brandon the Elf, aka Brandon Johnson, is clad in tight yellow pants and a green tunic. Johnson explains that his boss, Santa, sets the dress code.
Well, I mean, these were, you know, a uniform issued straight from the North Pole, and so that's just what Santa requires for us elves.
Johnson's here to deliver a Christmas tree. He takes his customer, Susan Noakes, to his truck to check the tree out. It's a 7-foot Fraser fir.
Oh, yes. I think this is going to be great.
That's
for your
gorgeous
place.
Yes, and it has a wonderful smell.
Included in the $130 delivery package is the chance for Noakes' 8-year-old granddaughter, Ollie, to rub elbows with Santa's helper.
How old is Santa Claus?
Oh, I don't know if anybody actually knows. He's getting up there. He's old.
Johnson is no stereotypical elf. He's an athletic 29-year-old who's a lumberjack most of the year. He runs a business trimming and clearing trees, just not the ones he delivers at Christmas. He buys those at a tree farm. Johnson came up with the idea of his holiday side job called Santa's Tree Delivery to offset the slow period of his lumberjacking work.
We need something to do in the winter when it gets too cold and snowy to climb trees. So essentially, I take all my guys from my tree business for the rest of the year, and we just transition from lumberjacks to elves.
Johnson and two of his elf pals have delivered roughly 100 trees around the Minneapolis-St. Paul area this season. He says the big trees are the most profitable. He can charge as much as $450 for a 16-footer. Johnson has a whole shtick going for his business. In addition to wearing the costume, he often blasts Christmas carols when he arrives at a house. Johnson hopes to ramp up the business next year with a big marketing campaign and more man or elf power to speed the deliveries. Maybe even out of state. In St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
And a few minutes ago, the Uber South Korea story will end with Uber Australia. The California-based company has now officially apologized for jacking its prices as people used its service to flee downtown Sydney, Australia during that hostage crisis last week. Truly sorry, Uber says, for rates quadrupling during the crisis. It did drop prices back down after complaints of price gouging when people wanted to get home as Sydney went into a kind of lockdown. Uber uses an algorithm to raise prices when demand goes high. You can see the algorithm in action for yourself by ordering an Uber car on New Year's Eve. In Washington Today, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
Coming up next on Wisconsin Public Radio, a festival of nine lessons and carols live from Cambridge, England, featuring the choir of King's College. And you can see a listing of all of our holiday specials coming up over the next several days at WPR.org.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a place to call home. Familiar voices, timely conversations, uplifting entertainment. Nearly 500,000 listeners tune in every week, benefiting from the programs made possible thanks to WPR member support.
Support comes from Gateway Technical College. Learn accounting when you want, where you want, and when you can. Gateway Technical College offers online, on-demand, two-year accounting degrees, 24/7, all year round. Visit gtc.edu.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine.